Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Great to have back Patty Nagai. She is a horticulturist at Shady Lane Greenhouse in Menominee Falls, a retired UW Extension horticulture educator. I think that's where we first met up on the air and had a lot of fun over the years talking extension horticulture. Well, she's taken all those skills and taken them over to Shady Lane. So, as we wanted to zero in a little on growing in containers, and she'll have some tips for what to do with for successful growing of in containers, and then we can talk about starting seeds and how to transfer them to your garden, and of course, what other questions you have. Patty, we'll give it a shot.
I'm up for the challenge, Larry. Whatever they throw at me, I'll do my best.
I know you will. And so, if you have a question or a comment or maybe an experience to share, I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 800-642-1234. It's 800-642-1234. Or send an email. Email address ideas@wpr.org. ideas@wpr.org. I imagine this is kind of a busy time or getting to be a busy time at Shady Lane.
Well, we're actually pretty busy all year long.
Yeah.
We're open.
Yeah.
Except major holidays. We're open all year. And we have a lot of different things that we do. So we are always busy, even when we don't have maybe a lot of customers. You know, so we plant millions of plants and, you know, put lots of different combinations together. We also have that fabulous G-scale train that is the largest permanent display in the Midwest. So we have a lot of people who come in just to see the train. We would like them to buy some flowers when they come in, but they really are just coming to see the train, which is pretty amazing.
That is very and where is it located? Menominee Falls.
Menominee Falls. It's right on Shady Lane, just off of Good Hope Road. It is in a really pretty little area.
Yeah.
It is a gorgeous little greenhouse. It's family owned. They just celebrated their 50th anniversary of being in business.
Must be doing something right if it's been 50 years.
I think they've been doing a lot of things right, and they have several family members who are working there and running different aspects of the business, and it's a great place to work. It really is. It's a lot of fun.
So let's look at containers for a bit.
Oh, sure.
What kind of problems can containers solve?
I'm a big-time gardener, as you know. I garden everywhere, but I have been using containers on my patio and on my deck. I do things up closer to my house where I can have a little bit better eye on smaller vegetables and herbs that I might want to use in cooking. I have things on my patio that I can move around. I have trees, so there are a lot of areas in my yard that are too shady especially for growing vegetables. So I grow a lot of edibles in containers all over my yard. And we do a lot of that at Shady Lane Greenhouse. We plant a lot of things for other people, but we also have classes to teach people how to do it.
Yeah.
Because I think there are a lot of homes, not just apartments or condos, that don't have space for a garden, but I think that there are a lot of homes that also think they can't grow certain types of flowers or vegetables because they don't have enough sun. But in actuality, if they grow them in containers, they can move those around and find the best place for them.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, yeah, and I always have plenty of containers around.
I garden everywhere, so I, you know, and I try to do it all. I try to.
So you're saying you could choose, well, you can't, you know, you're not going to be planting corn in a container, probably, but there are.
I have grown corn in containers.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness.
But that's a little more challenging. So, yes, it takes a lot of nutrition, a lot of fertilizer and a lot of care to grow corn in containers. But yeah, you could do it. It's possible.
It's possible. But if I've got my containers, I want to make them productive
right.
as possible.
And that's where plant selection becomes super important to make sure that you're selecting the kind of plants that, first of all, the things that you really like. things that look nice, especially if you're decorating your patio. You know, you want it to look nice in addition to being, productive and tasty. You want it to look good. So plant selection becomes really important in how you do the containers. Of course, the container itself is important. You want to make sure that they always have drainage, that you're using a nice, clean soil mix, which in my case, it's always a soilless potting mix that I use in my containers. I never use real soil in a container. I will mix in compost. I will mix a soilless planting mix with compost to give it a little bit more structure and a little bit more weight at times. So there are a lot of things to consider as with any type of gardening, but there are always solutions.
Now, container design, Jill was mentioning the thriller, filler, spiller.
Yeah, that's the traditional. That's the traditional method of planting. And I think everyone, when they're putting a container together, probably thinks about that because, you know, a container, when you're planting a container with multiple plants, it's a garden design. It's just in a smaller area. And so you think about things like height and flow and texture and color and, you know, the things that go on the edge of the pot need to be either shorter or there need to be things that will hang over the edge of the pot.
Yeah.
Whatever's in the middle of the pot, or if you're doing a three-dimensional thing that's going to be up against a wall, whatever's in the back of the pot is going to be taller. So I think everybody does that sort of intuitively, to do that. But it looks good when you do it that way. One of the reasons I wanted to talk about containers is that this past couple of weeks, Heidi has been planting all of these spring containers for it's like a business complex. So she's made 70 of them. I don't know.
Oh my goodness.
And they're big and they are absolutely gorgeous, you know, so she uses things like coral bells, heuchera, in the middle of the pot because they're brightly colored and they have these cool flowers. Or she'll use an ornamental kale like purple moon or purple ruffles or prism that has nice color and nice texture.
Yeah.
And then pansies and Johnny jump ups and stocks, flowering plants that are very cold tolerant. So then you end up with this gorgeous, colorful container, some of which is edible, that will withstand whatever Mother Nature throws at us for the next 6 weeks, which could be, as you know, anything. It could be cold. It could be hail. It could be snow. It could be rain. It could be 80 degrees. Who knows what's coming?
Probably all of those.
And maybe all of the above. Because, I felt like we went from winter to spring to summer to spring to winter to spring to winter to spring,
A mess.
Yes, absolutely.
As it often is here in Wisconsin. Scott in Pleasant Prairie has a question for you. Let's go
great.
There. Hi, Scott.
Hey, good morning, folks. This isn't container related, but it's something that's been burning a question in my mind for a very long time. It's on nightshades. Now, you've got a group of plants that range, I believe, from potatoes, tomatoes, peppers. To me, they don't seem to be related. And why would you call them nightshades? Does that term mean anything specific to them that would, help you identify different ones?
Yes.
That's just a simple question.
It's a great question. It's a great question. And I get this a lot because people who haven't studied botany and taxonomy and all these other things that these plant people study don't understand about plant families. And plant families can explain so much. So when you talk about nightshades, those are all plants that are in the Solanaceae family. So they are very closely related. We're talking lots of genetic similarity. And that particular family is fascinating because not only does it have, as you mentioned, tomato, pepper, eggplant, potato, it also has petunia in there. And tobacco, which kind of throws people for a loop when they go, tobacco. And then the other thing it has in there that is the reason it's called the nightshades family is that it has that whole group of plants called black nightshade, deadly nightshade. There's a whole slew of poisonous plants in that family as well, some of which are native to this area and can really hurt you.
Yes.
You would have to eat a lot of them, but I do know of people who have died from eating the climbing nightshade that grows rampantly across southeast Wisconsin. But they ate a lot of the little fruit. Some of the characteristics that are similar that you can look at more closely this year when you have your garden, the biggest one is the flower. If you look at the flower from eggplant, tomato, pepper, and even the potato flower, because they will flower, mm-hmm. and you can see it, those flowers are almost identical. They're different colors, and they might be slightly different sizes, but the shape of the petals, the structure of the internal part of the flower, the number of petals, that you can just look at it and say, oh yeah, that's in the nightshade family.
That is very cool. Scott, thank you very much. I appreciated that question. I learned a couple of things, and I bet everybody else did as well. Appreciate it. You can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. Kent emailed, when he started vegetable seeds inside, it seems like, even if the light is okay, low enough, they just get leggy.
Right. So there are several things you have to watch out for when you're starting any kind of seeds indoors. And, you know, seed starting is not difficult, but there are definitely some kind of tricks to it to make sure that you end up with a nice, healthy seedling. The timing of the planting, of course, is really important. You don't want it to spend too long in a seed tray, so you want to make sure that you have enough time for it to really germinate and grow, but not that it's staying in your house for, you know, 3 months before you can take it outside. Light is super important, and I always use LED banks of lights. I've used shop lights in the past, too. They need to be very close to the seedlings, like within a few inches above the seedlings, and you need probably 10 to 12 hours of that extra light a day to make sure that they get enough light. The second thing is I use little fans. Like I get these little portable fans that I can clip onto the side of my seed starting structure to give a nice constant blowing of the seedlings. There's a huge amount of research. It sounds so goofy, but there's a lot of research about how touch and movement affects seedling development and structure. And so just brushing your hands, and Larry's probably laughing at me because I'm using lots of hand motions here that no one can see, but Larry, but you can brush over the tops of your seedlings on a regular basis, like at least 3 times a day.
Just brush them. Every time you go by.
Every time you go by, you can talk to them and brush them like you're petting your dog. And every time you touch them, every time the wind blows or you have that fan set up, every movement that those little seedlings get actually helps to strengthen their stems. And it's because of this cool array of genetic, this transfer of touch into a physical change. So they're called touch genes, and they actually turn on calcium production in the cell wall. So you're making your cells stronger. It's like exercise for your plants. Mm-hmm. You're making your cells stronger. You're going to make the stem stronger. And when you start doing those kind of techniques with the light, the wind, the touch, you'll find that your seedlings are shorter and squattier and have thicker stems, and you won't have nearly as much trouble with things like damping off fungal disease and things that often plague our indoor seed starting efforts.
There you go. Thank you so much for that question. And let me remind you that Patty Nagai is our guest today. Horticulture expert. She works at Shady Lane Greenhouse in Menominee Falls, has done that for the last 6 years. And Jill Nadeau is our producer today. And Tyler Ditter is our technical director. And I am Larry Mueller, and you are listening to Garden Talk on Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with horticulture expert Patty Nagai. Great to have her along. You could email in a question for her if you'd like. The email address, ideas@wpr.org, or give us a call at 800-642-1234. You know, we've got a few calls here. Let's go to Andrea and Madison, see what's on Andrea's mind. Hi there. Thank you for calling.
Hi. One thing that I love using containers for is to bring scented plants up to where you can sniff them. I have a bunch of pots at my main entry that have lemon verbena in them, scented, especially attar of rose, rosemary, basil, Thai basil, things like this that you can touch on your way into the house, and suddenly there's this poof of wonderful scent, and you'd never come across that in the garden.
Oh, I love that. I love that so much. It's just, and that's so true. And there are so many plants that we can add to our containers. Even if you're growing flowers, you can add a lot of fragrant foliage or fragrant flowers to those containers and bring them up close to the house. It has an amazing effect on people's mood and outlook. You know, of course, the research about just viewing beautiful plants and being out in nature is tremendous, but the idea of fragrance is so important as well. And yeah, lemon verbena, lemongrass, any of the basils, and of course there's a lemon basil as well, and Thai basil is very fragrant, as she mentioned. It's just super. And then all of those scented geraniums, there are quite a few of them that are so incredibly tough. You know, geraniums are things that you can have in your pot really early in spring. They will make it through all of the heat of summer. They will still be going well into fall. And if you really wanted to, you could bring them into the house and keep them as a house plant, or as some people do, shove them in a closet and bring them back out in spring and they come back to life. It's just, they're amazing.
Actually, isn't this about the time you'd bring them out, cut them back down 6 or 8
yeah,
inches?
Yeah, they should be out by now. People who overwinter things like elephant ears or dahlias or gladiolas or geraniums, yes, those you should have those out and repotted and cut back and give them some nice fertilizer and put them in a bright location so they can get a good start. So they're ready to go outside when weather is ready for us to do such things.
Andrea, thank you so much. You know, as she was talking, I was thinking about my own front porch, you know, and I have flowers that are growing along the front porch. And I had some, what is it, ornamental tobacco.
And was it the Nicotiana sylvestris? Was it the white-flowered one or was it the little one?
No, it was the white-flowered one.
Very fragrant, especially at night.
Yes, and that was why I planted it. Put it in the first place because I like to see, you know, after you work, after the work's done and you're sitting out on the porch maybe with a cocktail or whatever, talking to the neighbors, and then that's when that ornamental tobacco takes over.
Right. It's very fragrant.
Oh, very
fragrant.
And
what I have found, I have some in my backyard. I had it in a container. And now I have it everywhere because it's self-seeded.
Oh.
Which is actually, for where it is in my garden, is fine. I don't mind it doing that. But there are plants like that that you have to kind of keep an eye on because they will propagate themselves very readily. Lemon balm is another one that will do that quite readily. Smells wonderful. I love lemon balm. But right now, in a certain area of my patio, the gardens around my patio, that's my biggest weed problem right now is lemon balm. So, but it's, you know,
there's worse problems to have.
I know, because when you're pulling it out of the ground, it's like, oh, that smells so good. Oh, that smells so good. Oh, I wish it wouldn't self-seed.
And your hands smell really good for a long time afterwards.
Well, you know, and I love that lemon fragrance, so I guess I shouldn't complain too much about it. But yeah, it'll completely take over your world.
Scott in Clintonville, we'll go to you now. Hi, Scott.
Hey, Larry, I just have a question. I've never tried to grow anything in a container, and I'd like to grow some tomatoes, but I'm just not sure what the best choice would be, or, you know, what size pot to get so I don't, like, overgrow and have to try to transplant it.
Right. That is an excellent question. And it's really interesting because I that's one of the things I specialize in at the greenhouse at where I work, is that I grow a lot of different types of tomatoes that are specifically for containers. And it is super important that you pick the right tomato.
Yes.
Because if you're trying to grow, for example, Cherokee Purple or Black Creme or one of those Brandywine, you know, an heirloom tomato or even something like Better Boy, those tomatoes, those indeterminate type tomatoes or tomatoes that are vining type tomatoes that can grow indefinitely, you know, they could get 20 feet tall if Wisconsin weather allowed them to do that. Those are just so very vigorous. They are way more challenging to grow in a container, even a really big container with a really big trellis. So what I specialize in for containers are more of the dwarf type tomatoes, or the semi dwarf. So there's one, for example, called Container Superbush that only gets about 2.5-3 feet tall. It makes a good sized tomato, has a really thick stocky stem. It only gets to a certain height and then it stops, and it's very productive. There are also little cherry tomatoes that are dwarfs, like Little Bing and Sweet and Neat Yellow, that are smaller plants, perfect for containers. In fact, you can grow those dwarf tomatoes in a 10 or a 12-inch porch pot. You can keep them in that size pot all summer long. You could even have a little flower on the front of it hanging over the front of the pot, and they will still produce all summer long. In that same series, there's one called Little Napoli, which is a plum-sized tomato, and Little Sicily, which is more of a round slicing tomato. There are a lot of dwarf and semi-dwarf tomatoes that you can grow even in fairly small pots, which are really nice. If you can't find those, at least make sure you're getting a tomato that is listed as a determinate or a bush type tomato. And then with that one, those still can be quite vigorous because they can get 4 to 5 feet tall. You're probably going to have to do some pruning, and you will have to have some extra support for them. A little trellis or a cage for sure to do that.
But yeah. You don't need them for example, the Superbush,
the Little Bing, Little Sicily, Little Napoli, Sweet and Neat Yellow, a single bamboo stake. Once they get to the stage where they're starting to produce fruit and they get a little top heavy, that's all you need is a single bamboo stake once they start producing fruit, just to give them some stability so they don't break off. Because they produce so much fruit that they could break, you know, the stems could break. So you want to give them a little bit of support at that point. But early on in their growth, you don't even need a stake for them. They're so stout.
I like that idea. I've never tried that Superbush. I might try.
That's a really good one. There's another one called Patio Tomato that's a little bit smaller.
Yeah.
But I like the taste of the Superbush tomatoes better. And that Little Bing tomato has the best cherry tomato flavor. It's really good. I grow another one called Topsy Tom, which is, you know, I rebelled against this for a long time because it's actually a hanging basket tomato.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
And I've always said that tomatoes should not grow upside down. I mean, it's just wrong. But people kept asking for it, so I thought, well, I'll try it. And so this Topsy Tom is actually kind of a nice little, it's also a shorter plant. It doesn't get super long. It does very well in a hanging basket. And the fruit is very tasty. It's a really good one, too. And for me, that's the clincher for what I grow. You know, I don't care how cute it is. If it doesn't taste good, it's off the list for next year. They have to taste good.
Scott, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Jolene in Chippewa Falls, let's go to you now. Hi, Jolene.
Hello. my comment is on your container gardens from last year.
Mm-hmm.
Last year we put some, we do vegetables, so we had tomatoes and peppers and those kind of things. So on a whim, we brought in one of the pepper plants, put it in the living room in the sun and grew it all winter. And here about 3 weeks ago, it started blossoming like crazy.
Of course.
And this morning, it actually has a small pepper on it.
Well, congratulations. Peppers are fun to bring. You know, peppers actually are perennial. You know, you could bring them inside. And the nice thing about peppers is that their plant size is somewhat smaller than, you know, than a tomato, trying to bring a tomato inside. But peppers will definitely grow perennial. I've had them for, I had one little hot pepper plant that I had for like 3 years, very successfully just growing it in my little garden window. And it was kind of, you know, kind of cute. After a while, they get a little ratty looking. So I think it just didn't meet my standards and it went away quietly. But I brought a pepper in this year too, because it was planted in a combo pot with another plant that I wanted to save. It was actually a really pretty little geranium. And so I wanted to save it, and I thought, well, I'll just leave that pepper in there. And it dropped all its foliage and looked like a stick. And then now it's leafing out and it's flowering again. So they're pretty tough.
You know, as long as we're mentioning peppers, I get this every year. People say, well, I got a great looking plant and then I didn't have any peppers.
Yeah, that happens a lot.
But I think people just get them out in the ground too
right.
early.
So there are a couple of things that can go wrong with those warm season vegetables. And, you know, peppers and tomatoes, these are warm season plants. They, and a lot of times people think, well, it's warm. It's, you know, 75 degrees outside. But you should really stick your finger down in the soil, because a lot of times the soil is not warm. And I do recommend using soil thermometers a lot, but I know not everybody has one. But, you know, if you put your hand down in the soil and it feels cold to you, it's probably too cold for those warm season plants. They really prefer a soil temperature well above 65 degrees. Above 70 would be better. So they can get chilling injury. You know, sometimes people put things out and they think if they cover it, or, you know, if they're having some sunny days, it's fine. But the roots are very sensitive. And if the soil is too cold, you can get chilling injury that's very long lasting. The other thing is, of course, fertilization. Sometimes people have soil that's a little too rich in nitrogen, or it doesn't have the proper balance. I always recommend that you do a soil test. You know, you can send that in to the soil analysis lab here in Madison, and they will do a home soil test at a very reasonable price for you and kind of give you an idea of where you are for vegetable production.
I don't put peppers out until June.
Yeah, I wait until after Memorial Day to do peppers and tomatoes. There are other things that you can plant in the spring.
Lots
of things. And, you know, I mentioned the ornamental kale before, but you can do everything in the brassica family. The Brassicaceae family is such a fun family to grow because everything's edible. You know, we talked earlier about the nightshade family and how some things are poisonous, so you really shouldn't eat everything in that family. But in the brassica family, everything's edible. The root, the stem, the buds, the flowers, the seeds, the leaves, everything. So you've got turnips, and you've got kale and cabbage and cauliflower and broccoli and arugula, you know, radish.
All
of these things are in the same family, and it's all edible. The flowers are amazing. So if you think that your arugula has to be pulled out of the garden because it's bolted and it's flowered, no, you harvest those flowers and put them in your salad because they taste really good.
Onions?
Onions are a completely different family, but they usually get planted a little bit early too. You have to be careful about onions because if it's cold and wet, you can get a little bit of rot setting in. But all of those you know, the mustards, the radishes, all of that stuff can be direct seeded into cool ground and do just fine. The lettuces are pretty tolerant. They take a lot longer to germinate, so that's one that I like to germinate inside. I will seed start lettuces inside and then put the plants outside when the weather's a little bit more predictable.
Yeah.
I'm shaking my head because this year has just been so crazy. It's just been weird, weird weather.
Norman in Wausau will give you a chance to join in. Hi, Norman.
Good morning. I wanted to make two different comments. One of them is on these leggy plants that you get from little seedlings.
Mm-hmm.
I agree entirely with your speaker about the need to have the light close to the plants. But one thing they found out by accident is often we have the temperature too high, because the first thing I noticed when I put them down in my basement, which is pretty constant at 50 degrees,
I
have those fluorescent fixtures right above the plants, is they got nice, thick stems rather than the tall, stringy ones. And I've done that now for about 5 years. It's worked out fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing that I found out, I saved my tomato seeds, which I know you're not supposed to do. But anyway, one of the five plants I put out came up like the rest of them did, but it only grew about 3 feet high, and it started blossoming about 3 weeks before the other plants. It only grew a short, like I said, about 3 feet. It had big tomatoes on it.
Nice.
And they got ripe about 3 to 4 weeks before my 80-day tomato plant. I told my wife to save the seeds from the first one ripe. And another thing, it didn't get blight on the bottom like most of my tomato plants.
It's perfect.
Even though I mulch them.
Well,
I think that's fabulous. I know Larry's about to say the same thing. I'm glad you saved the seeds because you might have this fantastic new cultivar. So I never tell people not to save seeds, but there's a difference between the types of tomatoes that you can save seeds from. So if you're growing hybrids, you know, like Better Boy or one of those, you know, those are hybrid plants, and the seed development is a little bit different. So your genetics of your progeny, you know, when you sow those seeds and grow them, you're going to get, you know, umpteen different types of plants, different fruit. They could have different fruit color. Every characteristic could be different. But when you save seed from a plant like Cherokee Purple or Black Creme or Brandywine, you know, any of those heirloom or what we call open pollinated tomatoes, the progeny should be very, very similar to the parent, because the reason that they are open pollinated and considered heirloom is that their characteristics are very stable. So genetically stable over a very long period of time. Tomatoes are not readily cross pollinated, and I think people get a little confused about that too. They can be, because of course bees do visit them.
Yeah.
So cross pollination can happen, but they don't really need cross pollination.
Right.
That's why you can get tomato fruit inside with just a little bit of a vibration. So the bumblebees are the best visitor to the tomato, because they do this thing called buzz pollination, and they vibrate the little flower because it's fairly contained inside.
Yeah.
So those open pollinated varieties, their characteristics are so stable and so heritable that they encourage you. You should collect the seed from those all together. But if you're collecting seed from a hybrid, there is no telling what you will get. And if you got a winner, and it sounds like you got a winner, you should be collecting seed from that plant every year and planting it out, because that sounds like a great plant. It's early. It has beautiful fruit. You didn't say if it's tasted good, though.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, they must have tasted good, because Norman is saving those seeds.
Saving those seeds, so yes, yeah.
And, now
and the other thing he mentioned, though, was temperature and seed starting, and he is absolutely right that temperature is super important. So when you're first starting your seeds and you want them to germinate really fast, warm is great.
Yeah.
But afterwards, a little coolness is actually better. Yep.
So we'll have next year, Norman's going to be planting those this year. So next year, when you're on.
I hope he calls back.
Well, Norman, you got to call back because
I think
he
needs to send me some seeds.
We can be his marketing agents.
I know.
Norman's
thinking,
amazing early tomatoes.
We could grow those out for you at Shady Lane Greenhouse and market them as Norman's amazing tomato.
Yeah,
This is a good deal. Any proceeds could come back to the Garden Talk show?
Absolutely. Why not? Norman, thanks a lot. Don't forget to call us back.
Oh, yes. I want to hear the rest of that story.
Keith and Kiwani, your turn. Hi, Keith.
Good morning. So I'm wondering about, growing the most nutritious vegetables.
Mm-hmm.
And understanding that, what we put them in is really important. And that's why I was wondering about, you said you didn't use natural soil, and yet, we know that the soil biology, the bacteria and the fungus and everything that's in the ground that breaks down organic matter and minerals and things to feed the plant is the best way to get the whole spectrum of micronutrients and things to the plant for healthy plants. And so I'm wondering why you wouldn't use natural soil in your containers.
Sure.
Oh, that's a really, really great question, and some excellent points there. And I agree with you with everything you said up until the point of trying to put that soil in a container. So in a natural planting bed or even in a raised bed on the ground, natural soil is best. It really is. And local soil. You should always try to work with, what you have. I do like using compost in the garden to improve the porosity and the organic matter of my soil in my raised beds and in my ground beds out in the yard. But in a container, natural soil actually does not work very well. It is so heavy and it compacts too easily. The things that we think about as being natural in the garden, as far as microorganisms and insects and worms and all of those things, are not happy in a container, and they tend to go a bad direction in a container. So we have too many issues with root rots and critters that are eating up the roots. They're, in a big garden space where you have a large area, everybody's happy. You've got your good insects and your bad insects and your good microbes and your bad microbes, and they kind of all balance each other out most of the time. But when you're in a confined space in a container, it just doesn't work. So the potting mixes that have absolutely no soil in them at all are really perfect for container growth. They still could be considered organic, and you can buy literally organic, as in legally, not just with the quotation marks around the name, but real organic potting mixes. Most of the potting mixes, I consider them organic in nature because they are made up of organic matter. The newer mixes that are super productive for container grown flowers, vegetables, herbs, everything are made of various composted materials, a lot of shredded and composted wood fibers.
Mm-hmm.
There's mycorrhizae in there. They often put in things like perlite to help with drainage. But the nice thing about those mixes is that they are consistent. And when you're planting in a container, it is really important that the mixture that you're using is consistent from top to bottom. There should be nothing in the bottom of that container. You should not have layers of any kind of other material. It should be exactly the same mixture from top to bottom, because that's how you're going to get the very best drainage and the very best root development. Containers are kind of tricky because you need to water them pretty regularly. You need to water them consistently, but you really need to know that that water is draining through thoroughly to the very bottom of the pot and coming out the bottom of the pot. Because in a healthy plant, especially if you're growing vegetables like peppers and tomatoes and eggplant in a container, that pot is going to be completely filled with roots. So you need to make sure that your moisture is consistent from top to bottom in that pot. Otherwise, you're going to get decreased fruit production, decreased flower production, and possibly damage to the plants because they're not going to get watered correctly.
Keith, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Patty Nagai, our guest today, horticulturist now at Shady Lane Greenhouse in Menominee Falls. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk. You're listening to Garden Talk here on the Wisconsin Public Radio Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Patty Nagai, horticulturist extraordinaire. And we are...
Thank you.
We're taking your calls right now at 800-642-1234. Or if you'd like, you could email us to ideas@wpr.org. And by the way, Steve in Boulder Junction says he uses an instant read cooking thermometer to find out his soil temperatures. Works great for him.
Well, I hope his cooking partner in life knows that he's doing that, but that's good. I have used meat thermometers before, but now I have like a whole collection of different sizes. I keep buying them. Like oh, this one's better because look how big the gauge is. Or that's really, I have a really long compost one that I use, and I've got them stuck in. Right now, I've got them all outside, stuck in different containers, and one out in my raised beds because I want to see how, if the temperatures. I gave up though. You're going to ask me what my temperature is, but I haven't been out there since the snow. I was too depressed about
it. Well, I paid a lot of money, over $100, for the instant read thermometer, cooking thermometer, and I have used it outside.
Oh, have you? Okay.
I figure...
Why not?
It's washable. I paid $120 for that thing.
Well, and you know what? You're growing food in that soil. So, like, you're going to grow, like, carrots, potatoes, radishes. Those are right in the soil, and you're going to bring them in and eat them. So why not put your thermometer out there in the soil?
I can wash it off.
Yeah.
Rosie in Ashland, your turn. Hi, Rosie.
Hi. My story is a green pepper story. Sorry, that backs you up some. When we were living in Muscatine, Iowa, my husband ran a Woolworth store where they sold plants. So we went and bought the healthiest-looking plant there was, and it turned out to be green pepper and actually bore fruit. So I cut it up and fed it to my daughters. You know, they would even take green peppers to school for lunch.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Even though nobody would sit near them.
You know what? I like green peppers that way.
I like all colors of peppers.
Yeah.
I grow them all. But I'm just still fascinated by the fact that Woolworth sold vegetable plants. I did not know
they
that.
They sold everything.
I didn't know they sold vegetable plants, but that's fabulous. You know, I think that when we grow vegetables in our gardens, whether it's in the containers or out in the yard, and we involve our children in that process...
Yeah.
It just helps, you know. When I was with Extension, we did so many children's gardens and community gardens programs with families, with kids. And it was just so, so very rewarding to see the kids out in the garden and exploring where their food comes from. You know, sometimes they didn't, you know, they really didn't know that this is how a green bean grows. Or, you know, then we would grow strange colored things like purple beans and they would, oh my gosh.
Well, some of my
amazing.
Some of my favorite times as a young kid were we had a big garden on the farm, and I spent a lot of time with my mother in that garden, and it was
And I would like to think that people are coming back to that. You know, I think that generationally we lost a generation of there's a whole bunch of people who don't know about gardening. But now it seems to be having a little bit of a resurgence. But I was like that as a kid, too. I spent most of my summers with my grandparents down in the Mississippi Delta. And my grandfather had an enormous garden that it was big enough that he had a regular farm-all tractor to prepare the garden. So we were out there every day.
Well, we use the farm-all tractor, too.
Oh, wow. Well, maybe we're related.
Vivian in Deerfield, Illinois, what's on your mind?
Hi, good morning. My husband is having stomach issues, and I recall my father had the same thing when I was a little girl. And my father was an avid vegetable gardener. He planted non-acidic tomatoes. I believe they were yellow.
Mm-hmm.
And I haven't had the occasion to really look for them specifically, but I'm pretty sure I have not seen those in years.
There's yellow ones. There's yellow ones out there.
Yeah, there are a lot of yellow tomatoes out there. The acidity level, though, varies a lot. And there, you know, for a long time that was popular. There were a bunch of varieties out that were considered low acid. But there are issues with low acid tomatoes, and the biggest one is that a lot of them don't taste like a tomato. You know, the taste is not good. And then if you can tomatoes, that lower acid affects the safety of the canning.
You have to add more lemon juice.
But we sell a couple of cherry tomatoes that are yellow that may be lower acid. We sell one big tomato that's yellow called Lemon Boy, which has an excellent flavor, really nicely behaving plant, good productivity, really nice flavor. But just
Lemon
because
Boy.
It's yellow, I'm not sure if it's considered a lower acid.
I liked
tomato
the Golden Boy.
Golden Boy is a good one also. We don't grow that one, though.
That's the one I grew it one year, and I loved it that year.
Lemon Boy has I always have it in my garden because it has a really nice flavor. The other one that I grow that has kind of a yellowy color is called Pineapple, but that's an heirloom tomato. So it's a huge tomato. It's a huge vining plant. Super flavor. Really, really nice flavor.
Well, Vivian, there you go. Thank you for calling. You've got some ideas there, or maybe.
I'm still thinking about that one. This might be my question that stumps me today because I haven't had anybody ask me about low-acid tomatoes in years. Like, this is, so now I'm going to have to go do some research.
Paul in Madison. Mm. Hi, Paul.
Hi there. I love container gardening. I love recommending it to renters who think that they aren't able to garden, but if they have a balcony that faces south or east, it's worked out pretty well for me.
Great.
I was wondering if you had any experience with wicking beds. I built one out of like a storage tote where the bottom half is all perlite, and it's great because it just stores all the rainwater and I barely have to water it.
Well, you tell me. Does it work for you?
Yes. I grow all my herbs in there.
Yeah. Do you have any issues with oversaturation or with algae development or anything like that?
I have seen a little bit of green kind of growing around the edges, but it hasn't seemed to affect the plants very much.
Yeah. It's, these self-watering and, you know, whether it's wicking or there's a lot of different types of containers out there that have self-watering devices of some sort. They're interesting. I've seen a lot of them in play. I've used a few of them myself. I'm not fond of them only because I find that they tend to keep things too wet. And maybe that's just, you know, that could just be the style that I have attempted to use. Paul, of course, if you don't get water in there, then they obviously don't stay too wet. But when the reservoir is completely filled with water, the soil tends to stay really saturated. And that can create some problems with root development and root rot. But it's an interesting way to grow, especially if you travel and you know you're going to be gone for a few days. In containers, when we get into the height of summer and you've got a container sitting out on a balcony or on a patio, it needs to be watered, you know, almost every day. And those self-watering types of containers can alleviate that issue. And I know that they can be used very successfully for some things. So I think it's just a matter of trial and hopefully not error, but just trying them out and seeing how well they work. It sounds like he's built one himself, which is fine. You just have to be careful about the kind of wicking material you use, because some of it will decompose over time. And then you have to look at the algae development and that saturation component. But other than that, you know, whatever works.
whatever works. Well, what really works is Patty Nagai. She does a wonderful job. A horticulturist at Shady Lane Greenhouse in Menominee Falls. Our guest today, I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on Wisconsin Public Radio. Listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Patty Nagai, retired UW Extension horticulture educator. She is now a horticulturist at Shady Lane Greenhouse in Menominee Falls. Questions for her? Give a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email us to ideas@wpr.org. Glenn in Columbus has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Glenn.
This is a watering question, but it's really on my house plants.
Okay.
And I just use my watering can and I kind of pour the water over the dirt. I don't think I put too much in, but eventually the water comes out of the hole on the bottom. Does that mean I'm watering too much, or does that mean that the excess water's coming out of it and I don't have to worry about the roots?
Okay, that is a super question, and it's so important to understand how to water correctly when you're growing any kind of containers, whether they're containers outside or houseplants in your home. Every container that you put a plant in really should have a drainage hole. There are some exceptions to that when we do things like terrariums, and then it gets really tricky. But when you have a houseplant in a container with a drainage hole, when you water that plant, yes, you should water it until you have drainage coming out of the bottom of the plant, of the pot. But you should not let the plant sit in that drainage water. So, yes, you want it to drain out the bottom, but no, you don't want that water to sit there, because a lot of times the number of roots that you have down at the bottom, like the very bottom of the pot, is the bulk of the roots. It's like the greatest portion of the roots for that plant. And if you have a half inch or an inch of water sitting in a tray and it's completely saturating the bottom of the pot where that half inch to an inch of root mass is located, it doesn't take very long for those roots to start rotting. I mean, the process can start in just a small amount of time, as just a few hours. So the best way to water, which, you know, I don't do this every time, but the best way is actually to take the plants to a sink, water, let it drain, let it completely drain, then put it back onto its tray or in its decorative container or wherever it is. Sometimes you can't do that. Like, I have huge plants in my house, and so I water very carefully. I water all the way around, especially with big pots. You want to make sure that you're saturating the whole surface so that you get good columnar flow of water from top to bottom. And as soon as I see water coming into the tray, I stop watering. Most of the time I get it right, and I just have a little bit of a drizzle in the bottom of the tray. And I use trays that have ridges so that the pot doesn't sit flat right. in the tray. It's actually sitting above the water. And if I do it correctly, then I just have a tiny bit of water in the tray, and I don't have to worry about emptying it, which is a real pain with big plants. You know, you just need to learn how much you need to put in there. But yes, you should have water draining out the bottom of the pot, because you want to make sure that the moisture is going from top to bottom so that you're completely moistening all of the soil in the whole pot for all of the roots that are in there. But then you don't water again until it's dry. And that seems to be the hardest thing for people, because the biggest reason that houseplants die is from overwatering. So overwatering is not watering so much that you have water coming out the bottom of the pot. Overwatering is when you water like that one day, and then you come back again the next day and say, oh, it needs a little bit more, you know, and you give it a little bit more. And then you come back the next day and you give it a little bit more. It's way worse to give it a little bit of water every day than to just water it once a week or once every 10 days, or in some cases, once every 2 weeks, and make sure that you're watering the whole pot.
There you go, Glenn. Thank you for calling. Appreciate it. Tom in Oconomowoc, we'll go to you. Hi, Tom.
How are you, folks? Kudos to NPR, and what a great program today.
Thank you.
Oh, thank you.
I want to relive kind of a humorous story. As a city boy in Chicago many decades ago, I bought my first home in a suburb, and I discovered there was not only a circular rose garden in the back, but a huge by Chicago city standards, a vegetable garden in the back that was about 25 feet wide and about 30 feet long. And the neighbor who sold the house to me had moved simply because he was getting older and didn't want to have a two-story house, but he said I should certainly call him if I needed any help with the vegetable garden. Well, I planted, and I learned the story behind this mysterious vegetable garden, which produced, for example, cucumber mounds that I had to stake and watch the vines grow up over a six-foot stretch of fencing and come down the other 6 feet and then start to creep out into the grass so that I could provide, for example, cucumbers for the entire neighborhood. This man was a Southerner by birthright, grew up on a farm, was a big exec here in the Chicago area, and moved because he couldn't handle the two stories. So the story I found from the neighbors, and he finally admitted, was he tried to grow vegetables on this plot with his farming background, so to speak, and nothing was taking. So he did some chemical analysis, he did some other things, and finally got frustrated, and I guess dug down 2 or 3 feet and had some soil loading that he apparently manufactured with the appropriate, I guess, chemicals and fertilizers. Well, I have to tell you, I had cucumber mounds that grew 6 feet up, folded over the top, and then began to stretch out across the grass.
Oh, my.
And I had the greatest sunflower collection as a windscreen at one end for 30 feet that probably had every bird in town coming to visit. So it was just a fantastic experience for a city boy who never saw anything more than a, you know, in those days, a memorial garden.
Wow. That's amazing.
Oh, Tom, that's a great story.
It is, and that's a good-sized garden. That's not a small garden at all.
No,
that's a big garden.
You could grow 700 square feet there.
You can grow a lot in that size garden.
Yeah, yeah. And it sounds like
he did.
Thanks, Tom. Great story. Oh, boy. Janine in Burlington, we'll go to you. Hi, Janine.
Hi, Larry. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I don't have a question, just a comment. I've always had a problem growing radishes, probably because I don't thin them enough.
Yeah.
And last year, I just let them blossom, go to seed. And when I wanted to clean out the garden, I pulled all the radishes out and I saved all those seed pots.
Mm-hmm.
They were awesome in a salad.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, radish.
They were just enough bite.
Right. It's funny because, you know, with things like radishes and arugula and a lot of things in that brassica plant family, You know, people think that it's done. When it starts to flower, they just, you know, they want to rip them out and plant something else, which you, of course, can do. But it's so great that you're using all of the edible portions. It tastes good. Those arugula flowers and seed pods, the, you know, she's experienced the radish seed pods. Yes, they are very tasty. And they're good for you. So, sure.
Good for you, Janine. Yeah. Thank you for calling. Oh, John in Richland County. Let's go to you now. Hi, John. John, are you there? Oh, we may have lost John. Probably lost John. That's all right.
Well, maybe John will call again.
He may be back. In the meantime, I want to go to Paula in Whitewater. She's got an interesting question here. She emailed that with the coming of cicada season, albeit they're great for soil aeration, how will they affect the garden? Will they be her? Will they be in her container plants?
Maybe.
They'll probably be pretty much everywhere, depending on where you live.
Yes, I'm anxiously awaiting cicada season. I just don't know. I don't really know what to expect as far as numbers and location. So, you know, the last time we had a cicada hatching
outburst.
I was going to say invasion. It's not really an invasion. They belong here. It's just they just emerge, an emergence. Yes. So, I don't remember them being that destructive. Especially for the ornamental plants or even the vegetables. But I think in some areas they could be, especially with two broods emerging at the same time. The numbers can be pretty overwhelming. But it's a natural phenomenon. You know, they have a right to be in this world as well. So, you know, they're not going to be here forever. I take the high road of enjoy their sound and the novelty of it and... You know, if they eat a little bit of your flowers, that's okay.
Another question she had was, what does she do with the plants she's overwintered still sitting in her basement?
Well, that depends on what they are, but it's time. It's time to bring them out into the light and start waking them up, pruning them back, cleaning them up, repotting them if need be. Start them on a regular fertilization. And that depends on what they are as to what kind of fertilizer you use. It is still too early to be putting things outside unless they are truly cold tolerant. The brassicas, you know, the cabbages, the kales, those can go outside right now. Pansies, Johnny Jump Ups, violas, stock, those kind of flowers can go outside. But it's still too early, even in southeast Wisconsin, to be putting things out like... You know, like dahlias or geraniums.
Yeah.
Weather is just a little too unpredictable at the moment to do that. We have some days, however, Larry, where you could put things outside during the day.
Yeah.
But you need to be able to bring them back in. And, you know, that brings up that whole topic of acclimation and making sure that you're not, you know, overdoing it with your plants. So, you know, if you've had something in the house all winter long, whether it's in your basement or it's in let's be serious. All areas in your house are probably very low light. So outside, you know, the sun is enough to do huge damage to plants that have not been acclimated appropriately. So whenever you're going to take anything outside to reintroduce it to the big wide world, you should put it in a protected area for the first few days just to give it a chance to reacclimate to that level of sunlight. You know, people have a very bad idea of sunlight and what light levels really are because our eyes adjust so readily.
Yeah.
But, you know, the deepest shade in your yard is way brighter than most places in your house. So you may think that it's shady, but your plant knows the difference. So be kind to it. You know, you have to remember that it's not just temperature. It's that really bright sunlight. It's the wind. It's, you know, all of the different environmental factors outside are really hard on plants that first week or so. So be kind to them. Do it gently. Do it slowly.
There you go. Roger in Little Chute, your turn. Thanks for calling.
Good morning. I read an article a couple weeks ago that using ethylene to start seeds is supposed to make healthier plants and so on and so forth. Well, I tried the experiment, and the ethylene, you don't have to buy a commercial quantity of it. You can use a ripe apple mm-hmm. or a banana. Mm-hmm. And yeah. I'm wondering if you have any information on that.
Well, you're just playing around with plant growth hormones, and that can be fun to do. Mm-hmm. And you might get some interesting response, but you might also get some really negative responses. So ethylene is a gas that's formed during fruit ripening. It's a natural component within the plant system. And it is used for a number of different plant growth regulation, you know, kind of factors to... The biggest one actually is flower drop. You know, ethylene is what causes flowers to drop. And if you get too much ethylene, it can also cause leaf drop, leaf abscission. So you're kind of playing around with a hormonal system within the plant that, you know, you might get a good response, but you might end up with dead plants if there's too much. Probably from one ripening apple, you're not going to get a huge amount of ethylene. But... You know, commercial growers use plant growth regulation and all the time to help control plant growth. But it is kind of tricky.
Yeah.
you can have very negative effects if you overdo it. But those kind of things are kind of fun to play with. So
yeah, why not? Roger, thank mm-hmm. you. Brett in Hurley, your turn. Hi, Brett.
Hi, Larry. I have a question. I have a raised bed garden up here because we have heavy clay soils. Mm-hmm. This year I'm thinking of letting those beds go fallow and looking for a recommendation for a green manure that I could plant in those beds and just let it go for the summer, just something easy to maintain.
Yeah, you know, the easiest thing actually is annual rye because that seed mm-hmm. is so readily available and it's very cheap, grows really rapidly. You can sow it pretty thickly and then...
Beat the weeds out.
So really thick. Let it grow. When it gets to the... You don't want it to flower, though. And that's true with any of these green manure-type crops or these... You know, you don't want to create a weed problem. So, because another one that's used is buckwheat. Buckwheat is a really good crop, or alfalfa. But if you let them flower and set seed, then you're going to have this huge number of seed in your raised beds forever. But as far as ease and cost, the annual rye is probably the easiest one to do.
Yeah.
And just when it gets to the point where it looks like it might be flowering, you need to go in there and at the very least cut it. If not, go ahead and turn it under.
Yeah.
And make sure that you're getting the full benefit of that growth into improving the condition of your soil. No, that's a good thing to do every now and then.
Not a bad idea at all, Brad. Thank you very much.
Great question.
Al in Milwaukee, your turn. Hi, Al.
Hi there. I have a question about radishes, which came to mind when the previous caller a couple of bags asked. Mm-hmm. When I was growing up in Will County near Joliet, Illinois, my grandfather always used to grow white icicle radishes, mm-hmm. which I loved.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody in Wisconsin seems to know about them. And I've tried to grow them a couple times here, and they don't turn out very nicely. Is that possible that it's too far north?
No, it's not too far north. It's probably your soil, though. So radishes are, you know, it's funny. Radishes, I always say, radishes are so easy to grow. And then people have so many problems growing them. So radishes, you know, they're in that brassica family. They germinate super fast. They grow really fast. But there are some kind of tricks to growing any kind of radish. And you have to have a really loose soil. So if you don't have naturally sandy soil, you know, the more organic matter to make it loose and well-drained. If you're doing things in a container, you can grow icicle radishes in a container, no problem. They grow really well,
in a container.
Yeah, so in a soilless mixture like that, because it's so loose and so well-drained. The other thing is, sometimes the pH can affect it. In our area, our soil tends to be a little bit heavy for radishes, so I only grow them in containers, or I have some above, like I have raised beds that are actually on posts that are filled with artificial soil mix, and I grow radishes in there. They do pretty well in there. But you should be able to grow icicle radishes
Put them in
without any problem. The man that I work for at Shady Lane, who's 88 years old and has been growing radishes his entire life, actually grew a whole bunch of them in containers in the greenhouse, in little plug trays. He grew radishes. They were beautiful and very tasty. So, yeah, I would say if you're having trouble growing them in the ground, just get a container and you should be able to grow as many radishes as any one person could probably want.
Al, thank you for calling. Stephen in Milwaukee wonders if you could recommend any type of lightweight material in the bottom of a very large container in order to reduce the amount of...
Oh, yes. I get this question a lot.
That you need, or the weight of the container.
Yeah, I don't like doing that. I just don't like putting stuff in the bottom of a container for... it's just a physiological, or maybe it's a physical reason, because it really messes up the water flow in the container. If you're using a lightweight soil mix, I know it's expensive when you first set it up, but it's really much better if you can just use a lightweight soil mixture and just have it from the top to the bottom. You're going to
be happier.
You will be happier. Your plants will be happier. And you don't, you know, with those really huge containers like that, you don't have to replace the soil every year. You can leave that soil in there as long as you're doing ample fertilization and you're not having any issues with diseases or insects. You can leave that soil in there. I do that in my containers all the time. The other option would be to use an insert instead of planting directly in that container. Maybe you could find a liner, like a nursery pot, that is not as deep, that you could put, and we do this with really huge things, where we'll put upside down pots on the bottom, and then the liner that's actually growing the plants sits on top of those pots. But the pot itself that is growing the plants is all filled from top to bottom with the same soilless mixture.
Yeah.
So that is another option. Instead of trying to fill the whole container with soil or soilless mixture, try to find a liner that will fit down in there so that you can raise it up a little bit.
And in 15 seconds, Mark wants to know he overwintered his dormant potted lantana tree in a dark room. He wants to resurrect it to bloom again this summer.
Well, I'm hoping it's still alive. I'm fingers crossed that it is. But bring it out into the light. Prune it back. Give it some good flowering plant fertilizer like Blossom Boost. You know, really
do it
be
that way.
Careful about not watering it too much. And get it
there. You go.
Get it into the light, but don't put it outside yet. It's too cold.
Patty, the guy. Thank you so much, Patty. Retired UW Extension horticulture educator. She now works at Shady Lane Greenhouse in Menominee Falls, Wisconsin. Thank you so much for listening. Beth DeAngelo, our tech expert, is back to talk about all things IT on Monday. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR.